informative.
Yes, so the first third of this talk is with my collaborators, Charles Doering, who's here, and my colleague at Imperial, Thanasis Phokas, and the back two-thirds is with Koji Okitani from Kyoto. We did this work at the Newton program a year ago on turbulence, so we're sort of slightly out of phase, as it were. But talking about my title, you know, solutions, shortened title, solutions of the Euler equations, it's actually rather apt, because if one goes in this long history, the saga of the Euler equations, 250 years old, or the Navier-Stokes equations, like 150 years old, we have a few exact solutions, but not many. And somebody like myself, who spent 10 years failing to prove the regularity of these sort of equations, exact solutions are nice to have, because they sort of place you, even though some of them are idealized, they sort of place you as to where you are in a certain type of flow. For instance, we know that Hill's spherical vortex is an exact solution of 3D Euler, for instance. But for Navier-Stokes and Euler, probably the best known and most used and most observed in numerical computations are what's called Berger's vortices. And they're about, I think this came up in Berger's paper in 1948, so they're over half a century old. And what Berger's did is the following. Which is the best side to stand on? Is this the best side? Thank you. Thank you. Okay. What Berger's did, he took a strain field. You see, this is divergence-free. Z, I'm British, so I say Z, but I occasionally switch to Z when I'm in America. Okay, so I'm not going to be... Consistency is not a virtue in this respect. Okay. And this wave this string function here is only a function of x and y. These are partial derivatives. And of course, this is curl-free, and if you take the vorticity, capital omega, this only has vorticity in the k direction. And it's very easy to actually get the exact solution, because you've only got the vorticity equation, the Helmholtz equation. The strain matrix, which would be here, actually decouples in block diagonal form. It's mainly because of this Z here. You see, there's no Z or Z actually in that part. And because it decouples into block diagonal form, that's why you've got this gamma here. Okay, now Berger's took gamma a constant. And this, of course, I won't insult your intelligence by going into detail about solving, this, in effect, the heat equation, because that's what it is if you take an axisymmetric flow. But when you solve this, the merit of this thing is that if you take a large time solution, so if you take lim of omega as t goes to infinity, it doesn't decay to zero, it actually has something left. It goes like over 4 nu, and there's a gamma here, and there's a gamma there. And so you have this exponential profile here, which I have on a plot. It's not a function of z. And if you look at this bottom plot here, down here, what you're actually seeing is a section through the xy, z coming out of here. So you have an infinite rod of vorticity from minus to plus infinity with an e to the minus r squared profile across it in intensity. And this is, in effect, the Berger's solution. And people forget, actually, that it's actually an infinite... It really is an infinite rod. It's not on a finite domain. And it's precisely this object, what you're seeing here. Now, if you didn't take the axisymmetric solution, you took a different symmetry, you can get a sheet-like object instead. And this is what's called a Berger shear layer. And omega, as here, omega comes out of the blackboard into your eye, just like so. But morally, they're essentially the same thing. And they're very nice to have. Now, when I was at Newton, I realized that every very respectable fluid dynamicist had one of these nice cubes where you have vorticity, and they had their own. And since not being a respectable fluid dynamicist, I thought, well, I better borrow somebody else's who is respectable. So I took this out of Vincent and Meneguzzi's 94 paper. And of course, One of these are well known, I think these are ISIS surfaces, at some Reynolds number 150, and of course just one of these little objects we interpret as a Burgers vortex tube. But in reality, of course, you've got a huge soup, a spaghetti of these things. Moreover, these things often form in coils and straighten up, they have a finite lifetime and they vanish again. Everybody knows these things, I'm just sort of illustrating. So to go from one infinite rod to as an exact solution to a soup like this is a very long jump. And I'm not pretending to even solve that, but that's where part of the problem lies. So the question is, can we do something with a solution of this type? Can we do something with a solution of this type and get much more sophisticated solutions than this, although this would be buried in it as part of the class? Okay, because, you know, people sort of say, oh, well, the vortex tubes, they always have vorticity going down the axis of the rod, and if it doesn't have vorticity going down the axis of the rod, it's not a tube. Well, actually, you can actually get much more sophisticated solutions than that, as I'm going to show you. Now, the thing is, the Burgers solution actually poses as many questions as it answers. Because in some sense, you see, what you have, the vorticity is decoupled from the dynamics of the strain, and of course there is no dynamics in the strain here. He just simply puts a number, gamma, and says let gamma be some positive number, and that's where it is. And of course that doesn't connect with the rest of the flow, because this vortex tube sits in a much bigger flow, which is doing, and they're interacting with one another. So we need, or we would like to be able, to have something more sophisticated than this, even though this is actually buried in it, as an example. So that's what I aim to do. No, it's gamma really, which is related to the strain around the tube that would perhaps create the tube in the first place.
Yeah.
Well, that's what I'm going to do. That's exactly what I'm going to do. You see, Burgers was a very clever guy, and he did all sorts of things, and this is one of them. But as I say, it's an exact solution, but it sort of poses as many questions as it solves. So what we're going to do, I'm going to take the Navier-Stokes equations, 3D, I'm going to take a velocity field, U1, U2 and U3, and I'm going to sort of take some inspiration from the Burgers solution by having my U3 linear in Z. Okay, so Z is not in U1 and U2, but it is here and it's linear in U3. But now my gamma here is going to be a function of X, Y and T, and then I have this W added on. Now you can see the vorticity field is really rather nasty. I've now got these now two extra components, and by the way, scalar omega, when you see it, is going to be this omega 3. That's the same as this thing, capital omega 3. Okay. And just as a comment, which I will use later, you can actually see that when I write down the full Navier-Stokes equations in vorticity form, I no longer have this block diagonal coupling, but I do have this nice relation between the other components of the vorticity field sat in here, and that will actually be to our advantage later on. Okay, so what can we do with that? Well, this is what we can do with it. I've rewritten, in the green box up here, I've rewritten that form of solution linear in Z, yet again, just to remind you, and the first result, which I will prove on the next slide, and you can do it in one slide. I possibly am over-dignifying it by calling it a theorem, but nevertheless, omega, gamma and W basically satisfy these three separate equations. And here is the same equation for omega as we had before. W satisfies a very similar equation, except I have a minus gamma now, and that will be important. And now to answer your question, Grisha, gamma now satisfies this equation, and this PZZ of T, what it is, it's the second partial derivative of the pressure, which must be spatially uniform for this solution to be valid. So it is a restriction. But it is an arbitrary function of time.
You mean spatially uniform in X, Y, and T?
Yes, because Z is not in any of these. Z is not in any of these, so there is no Z at all anywhere. So these are all like two-dimensional equations. And so if we want to express...
You don't even have a Laplacian of pressure be uniform. You want pressure be...
This is PZZ.
Yeah, I understand. It's
yeah. So you'll see next slide.
Okay.
Okay, now of course the divergence-free condition, the full divergence of the full three-dimensional field, if I take little u as just these two guys you see here, then that thing turns into div little u is minus gamma. So there's no divergence-free condition here built in at all. But now this total D, of course, is a two-dimensional object. So everywhere here, you know, there is no DBDZ component. Okay, now the proof of those, because these are going to be the fundamental equations we're going to work with. We're going to do two things with them, as I'll explain in a moment. But the proof of this is actually very simple. And the method is an old and well-tried method in fluid dynamics. And the proof is very simple. Just simply take my third velocity component linear in Z and take my third equation, Navier-Stokes, third component of the Navier-Stokes equations. See, PZ, d by dt of U3 and full 3D Laplacian. Differentiate through. Now, of course, total d by dt of Z is U3. Okay, and so when we do that, we simply get this is linear in Z, and that is not. We can integrate with respect to Z, and this is your classic stagnation point type flow of quadratic in Z squared. I mean, this is a very well-known method. People have been using this for a century. And what it's saying is the pressure is quadratic in Z with coefficients like that. Now, when we first looked at this, we thought, oh dear, this is a problem. And then you realize that the problem actually gives you the answer in one line. Because, of course, that when you turn to the other two components of Navier-Stokes, the X component and the Y component, there's no Z in those. So there's no Z at all in those other two components. And that means that Px and Py must be independent of Z. Well, the only way that Px and Py can be independent of Z is that if these guys are purely functions of time, or constants, or zero, just any functions of time will do, and then you're okay. So that, and what that does, it nails these two down, and this C1 of t actually you can put to zero, because it's just like going into an accelerating frame in the z direction. But you can't put this one to zero, and that is where your PZZ comes from, which is an arbitrary function of time. Well, that's your integration constant from integrating with respect to Z.
This is still some arbitrary function.
This is like the two-dimensional part of the pressure that's left in the problem.
So it exists.
It does exist, yes. You can't have it zero. Yeah. But we don't need to know what it is at this point. Now, if I won't bother you with it, but if we go back to here, and now this form of the strain matrix here, we now see that this actual form, if I multiply omega onto S, we can actually now see that we get a very nice cancellation when we multiply onto these two rows. And when you do that, you're in luck, and the structure of the omega equation survives exactly as it was previously, and you still just get that. So that we first of all did the proof through the vorticity equation, and it took about 10 pages. And I thought this was some really difficult and deep result, and then we tried it through a colleague of mine, Rupert Ford, suggested we try it through the pressure field, and it came out in one page. Okay, so let's just return. Let's just return to this theorem 1 in the red box. So now what we have are three equations for omega, w, gamma. We would like to do something with these. Solve them in some way, obviously. The question is how and what do we do? Well, there's two routes. The first route is to take the simple route and take gamma only as a function of time, which is the next most complicated step up from what Burgers did. And then, when we've done that, we'll take the second route and we'll leave these completely all as functions of space and time, and then we'll have to numerically integrate these things and do a little bit of analysis on them. So I'll do the first route first and take gamma as a function of time. Okay, now this is where one bumps right into Tom Lundgren's famous 1982 paper, because it's sort of very much the first half of the result is really Tom's result. And I've put Tom's name up here because this is essentially what he did. If we now take we're taking gamma only as a function of t. If you take U1 and U2 in strain form here with this two-dimensional part, then automatically my U is divergence free, and one chooses, and this is Tom's straining transformation, one chooses e to the integral of gamma, we call it S, okay, and then you rescale your x and y coordinates with S, you strain them, you stretch them, and you define a new time variable tau. And with that choice, if you rescale omega with s to the minus 1 and call it omega tilde, then the omega equation just becomes 2D Navier-Stokes. Exactly 2D Navier-Stokes. And this is Tom's result. That he's in a sense saying you can take a solution of 2D Navier-Stokes, any solution, and map it back into this 3D solution of Navier-Stokes with this linear Z, and you've got a new solution of 3D Navier-Stokes, but it does have this linear in Z form. I should say, Tom, your paper, of course, this is the Lundgren spiral paper, and everybody in the universe has heard of the Lundgren spiral, but when you say to people, in Tom's paper you can actually get an infinite set of solutions of 3D Navier-Stokes from 2D Navier-Stokes through this transformation, people say, oh really, I must look at that. And I say, well, it's actually on page 1 in the right hand column. Yes. Well, that's a good question. Let me come on to this. Because it's a question of gamma's positive, there isn't a problem with tau. If gamma's negative, then t to infinity doesn't necessarily imply that tau goes to infinity. However, this is basically Tom's result. Now, we've added in this capital W. And now, if you rescale W, and now it goes the opposite way. You see S to the minus 1 here and S there. Curly W, now this W becomes basically a passive scalar riding on this 2D Navier-Stokes flow. And so essentially one has reduced it to 2D Navier-Stokes with a passive scalar. And so if you have any solution of 2D Navier-Stokes and this, you can reconstruct a full solution of 3D Navier-Stokes in any way you want. Okay, so... Now,
so far there's no forcing, right?
Well, there's the gamma equation, which is the separate equation. So if we go back, it's a good question. Everything is being run by gamma. And of course, PZZ of t is an arbitrary function of time so far. So in some sense, in this problem, gamma can be arbitrary, in the sense that this driving function can be arbitrary. And if gamma's arbitrary, then, of course, to some degree, S can be arbitrary. Gamma really is sort of running the vortex like a puppet. And if gamma is negative, S is decreasing. And if gamma is positive, then S is increasing. So it's then a question of which way these variables scale. Because, of course, this has S on it, and this has S to the minus 1. This has S on it, and this has S to the minus 1, so they're moving in opposite directions. Okay. So now one could construct, one could spend the whole of the rest of the talk constructing all sorts of solutions. But in some sense, because gamma is arbitrary, you can almost construct anything you want, and it isn't very instructive. And so just after this slide, I just sort of want to summarize what you can do, and then I want to move on to the full spatial equations where gamma has space as well as time, because that's more interesting. But just let's see what we have. The 3D vorticity is now this object. And so now what we've done is construct a vortex which not only has axial vorticity, omega, but it also has these other components here too. So if we think of this as a tube, we have omega going down, little omega going down the axis, but if we turn this into radial coordinates, we've also got some omega theta and we have some omega r. And clearly, if gamma is a function of time, these two guys have gone, but of course the W hasn't gone.
And of course, W is Z-independent.
W is Z-independent, they're all Z-independent.
There are linear terms in Z
and omega. Yes, they're here. They're here, but you see, when gamma is a function of time only, these have vanished. And so there actually is no Z component of this. So it actually is still a uniform rod to the eye in terms of Z, but it still has radial and azimuthal components. So it looks like a tube visually, but it really does have some omega theta and it does have some omega r in it. And so the vorticity vector isn't in this tube, it is not axial. It's actually moving around, you see. So that's the sort of, that's the first thing you can say, that not all tubes have to have axial vorticity.
So it's actually a spiral?
Well, it isn't a spiral structurally because this Z has gone.
Uh-huh.
The vorticity vector is moving around. Can be doing this.
Could you at this point maybe comment on this work earlier by Konstantin Prokashev and Siegel, who claimed that it is the viscosity that actually causes alignment of the vorticity with the tube?
Yes.
I guess you're saying that doesn't need to be true.
I guess that's probably so, yes. Yeah, it doesn't.
So can you then identify where they went wrong?
No, not without some thought and rereading what they wrote.
This is
still imposed. Yes, this gamma, you see, in a way, think of this as a vortex. You've got this sort of vortex, and gamma is a bit like a puppet master. And gamma is still this sort of imposed thing, and it's what it's doing is, you see, that when gamma is positive, omega is increasing and omega r and omega theta have to decrease because the s goes the opposite way. When gamma is negative, those parts increase and these parts decrease, which is hardly surprising when you have an incompressible flow. So it either stretches this way and compresses that way or expands this way and compresses that way. Yes?
So W is really an axial flow, capital W.
W is the x and y
dependent part
of
the z. It was that. So it's a velocity field.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's x and y dependent.
Yes, absolutely. Yes. So it's x and y dependent. So the point here is, I think, what we've already agreed. But it's in 2D Navier-Stokes and the passive scalar equation, and any solution of those is mapping through.
Right.
Well, the question probably is, if you substitute your solutions, will this term disappear?
I don't think it will. No.
This is it. When you transform this from 2D to 3D, the viscous term is balanced by your continual stretching transformation.
Well, that's only the axial. I mean, that's the conventional thing, that when you have a Burgers tube, that stretching and viscosity basically balance, which produces this finite residual solution here.
Right.
But that's only the axial component.
And that's only steady state.
And that's only steady state.
Right.
And it's,
Everything's changing in time, but when you get down to the scale of the viscosity term, things are changing, but at the very smallest scale, the viscosity term should still overwhelm.
But the tube?
Except for the compensation.
Wait till see where he goes.
Okay, let's see.
Yeah, okay.
The viscosity
so the point is, I think. I don't want to spend any more time on this, because as I say, you can have any gamma you want, and you can play a game and construct any vortex.
So, for example, if you didn't want benchmarks for numerical, for 3D numerical schemes, you could create some exact solution benchmarks, which is just evaluating functions, and then check your numerical scheme for accuracy. So that would be useful for that.
Okay, that's a good point, Charlie. I mean, what this is, what it would be a nice project for a new student to do who is good with graphics is actually to take a few well-known solutions of either 3D or of 2D Euler, say, even, because this will work for Euler as well as Navier-Stokes, and then map it into 3D and look at what the 3D graphics look like, and you might produce some animal that is totally unrecognizable in 3D but comes from some extremely innocent looking solution in 2D.
Or
the other way around, yes. And so you can construct many 3D, you can even construct singular solutions of Navier-Stokes and Euler by simply putting a singular gamma, impose a singular gamma on a 2D Navier-Stokes solution.
Means
with a singularity, if you wanted to. Anyway, so let's move on. Let us move on. And in fact, just briefly, you can see how the Burgers vortex, which I've written over here, if I took an axisymmetric point source solution of the heat equation, which is 2D Navier-Stokes if it's axisymmetric, then that's the thing, when I map it through with positive gamma, that actually ends up as this thing for the 3D Burgers solution. That's an example of what you can do. And in a sense, it's sort of rather obvious. Okay. And I've given some references here. If you want to read a nice paper on Burgers vortex and Moffat, Keeter and Occhitani in JFM 94, of course, there's Tom's famous paper in 82. I mean, in a sense, all we've done here is a little bit of an add-on to the Lundgren straining transformation in the first place, not much more. And these particular results are in this paper in Physica D. It was rejected by Physics of Fluids, this particular piece of work, as not being worth anything or relevant.
It's third author.
Yeah, I think it... yes, I mean, I gave this talk at Bob's GFD meeting, and I said it was the only GFD in the actual content of the material. Okay, and so now what I want to do is work which I did with Koji Okitani, basically going back to the full equations with full spatial dependence.
If I take gamma as stochastic function, there's nothing you can say that is.
Well, I suppose yes, you could.
You can
essentially construct this solution, and you'll have a tube with an omega theta, an omega r, and an omega, and it'll be dancing around all over the place.
You can do statistics.
Yes, of course.
This looks pretty
good. Yeah.
Has anybody investigated the stability
of this solution? No. Well, you see, in sense of stability, if gamma becomes positive and stays positive, then the axial omega wins and the other two die. If gamma turns negative and stays negative, you've got to be a bit careful with your question, because the tor doesn't necessarily go to infinity. It might become finite, even though t goes to infinity. It's the omega r and the omega theta that win, and the axial that dies. So in some sense, there is no stable state where they all survive for long times.
But I guess it may be unstable in a wider sense, in the sense that you consider some restricted class of the flow.
Okay.
It's still unstable with respect to agent some perturbation outside of this class. Right.
Let me come back to that. Maybe if I have time, I have some remarks on.
I mean, essentially, you have some sort of exponential time to the stationary solution.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Of course,
yeah. Yeah.
So you might be able to perform a stability analysis on that simple time dependence.
Okay. I hadn't thought of it that way.
Time dependence, I wouldn't suggest.
Yeah. Okay. I understand what you mean. So, morally now, what are we going to do? So what we now have are these equations for omega, W, and gamma. I'm going to put them in a tube. okay? And we're going to take infinite, it has to be infinite in Z, and we're going to take our cross section in X and Y, and that will be L squared, okay? And so my little u here is basically now this two-dimensional problem.
Okay.
Well, we're coming to that. Now, what we're going to do is put periodic boundary conditions on this cross-section. So I think of it as Euler in an artillery tube. Basically, you've got this infinite tube, okay, and you basically are looking at 3D Euler in that particular geometry. Because you, with this linear in Z, you can't really sort of restrict it by boundaries. And that's no different than what Berger's does. All the Berger's solution is an infinite rod. So, now we put boundary conditions. That's going to say something about PZZ. Now, what does that do? Now, the divergence-free condition in 3D means that in 2D, div u is minus gamma. And if div u is minus gamma, that essentially says that my integral across my cross-section must be zero on periodic boundary conditions.
Gamma is now
xy-dependent. Yeah, yes. We're now going back to the having them all xy-dependent.
That gives us a two-dimensional operator.
Yes. Two-dimensional. So everything, gamma, omega, w, are functions of x, y, and t. Z has been stripped out of the problem. It's not there. So if this is so, this must be so. So you're now restricting. Gamma has to be a mean zero function on this, basically, cross-sectional square.
Have you relaxed that? Have you had your boundaries squeezing in and out or something?
I guess you could, yes. Yes, I guess you could. I hadn't actually thought of that, but yes, I suppose. Yeah. Now, if gamma is mean zero, you integrate across the gamma equation using this, and that tells you that PZZ, and this answers Grisha's question, PZZ is forced to be the negative of the L2 norm of gamma. That's simply for consistency's sake. And so PZZ is now no longer arbitrary. And so now what you have are now your gamma equation, and it's a rather interesting Riccati structure where you have negative nonlinearity, but it's competing against twice its L2 norm. So the function is competing against its spatial average all the time. And then you've got omega and W here, basically being driven by gamma. And of course, gamma could be negative or gamma could be positive.
It's listed already.
Yes, I've chosen Euler for simplicity. Okay. Now, the point, I don't want to dwell yet on the numerics, but can I just make a remark that when you're solving these, the actual little u underneath still satisfies minus grad, say, capital P. And you think, well, isn't this just 2D Euler? Well, it's not, because div little u is minus gamma, you see, so it's not divergence free. In some sense, it is. Now, but when you're actually going to integrate these, you don't need to solve this. All you need to do is that because div u is minus gamma, let me rub this off, you don't need to go to the original u equation, because there's a Hodge decomposition of u. Because if div u is minus gamma, that's saying that u1x plus u2y is minus gamma. And if omega is curl u, that says that u2x minus u1y is omega. So I can actually say that u1 is minus Laplacian to the minus 1 of gamma x plus omega y, and u2 is minus Laplacian to the minus 1 of gamma y plus omega x, like so. And then you can just directly solve your omega, w and gamma equations with your u field connected in that way. And so it's not a particularly difficult problem. That's how omega and gamma get coupled. And this here is exactly equivalent to the Hodge decomposition, that it equals grad of inverse Laplacian gamma you know, a Hodge decomposition decomposes a vector field into a gradient part and a curl part, minus curl of K inverse Laplacian omega. And that here is basically this, and you've got exactly that decomposition. Some people call it a Helmholtz-Hodge decomposition, but that's exactly what it is.
Is there a relation between curl of T and gamma?
You can work it through if you want, yes. But you don't need to solve for this P. It's not necessary in this particular problem, in the way I've just described.
That's good, because if there was an incompressible Euler equation,
yeah,
then of course there would be a relation between the two.
Yeah, but you're right, it's compressible, but not conventionally compressible in the standard fluid way of how the density, etc., actually couples it.
It'd be
yes, exactly. So what we want to do is to solve this system.
Okay. It looks like it is incompressible case with external sources. And the average net effect of sources is zero.
Compressibility is not related to
the
dynamical weight.
Yeah, that's right. So you're right, but I'm not sure we gain any advantage by that analogy in that sense.
Sources are moving around.
Yeah.
But that's exactly your part of
math. Yeah. Okay. Okay, so we'd want to do just a little bit of analysis to guide us in numerical solutions. So here is my cross-section with the Z coming out. Okay, actually, I should remark that although this is a 2D system, it's because dView is minus gamma that reflects the fact that it's really 3D, and so you're not having particles just lying in the plane. Particles can come from infinity, and their sources from infinity and can come along the tube and do things in your cross-section. And so this is really reflecting the 3D nature of the problem. Okay, so what we do is we take our cross-section and we take parts where gamma is negative and parts where gamma is positive, and they're not necessarily simply connected. And if we define plus or minus gamma to be in this form, so this takes away than any negativity part, you can define these ratios of LPs. You don't really need the mod because both of these things are positive. You can define the ratio of these objects, and the mean zero condition basically says that the bit under the plus part must equal the bit under the minus part. Fairly obvious. Okay. So
I missed that. Minus and plus have anything to do with the sign of vorticity?
No, just gamma. Only gamma.
Only
because gamma is quadratic nonlinearity, not cubic, and therefore it can jump around positive and negative. Okay. Now, this top pair of lines, in some senses, they're superseded by this, because this is really here. The P equals infinity, F infinity is gamma infinity in this particular thing. And in fact, this is an equality, because you can do the proof of this in a slightly different route than the proof of those, so it's a nicer result. But what it says is that the time derivatives of gamma minus infinity and plus infinity are given exactly by these relations. And you see gamma infinity minus squared competes with twice its average. So it's how do spikes go against the average?
You get those equalities by some maximum principle?
I'll show you. It's a four-line argument. There's nothing, no big deal in it. Okay, so I've actually written down what I want to say. You see, what one is seeing is that if you compare a spike in gamma minus to the root mean square average, and if a spike sticks out more than twice root 2 times the RMS average, the derivative will be positive, and it will simply keep growing forever. Okay, if gamma plus is greater than root mean 2 average, its derivative will be negative, and it will be suppressed. So it looks like that positive parts of gamma are suppressed, and that negative parts are amplified. So it looks as if you're going to have...
Big plus.
Yes. So it looks as if... I can't draw this very well... that you're going to have flattening across here, and then actually the integral under here is equal under there. So I have, it looks as if you've got this happening, but that happening. It looks as if it's flattening.
Special distribution at some moment.
Yes, exactly. Now, of course, that principle only holds provided the L2 norm remains finite. As soon as if the L2 norm blows up, then you've lost that whole sort of comparison. And there's a little twist to the tail of this story. Peter Constantine did some work on this, which I've referenced down here. But we want to keep this principle in mind when we look at the numerics.
Is there another example where the RMS and the peaks are work against each other that you are aware of?
No, I'm not. We've hit a bit of luck in this problem in that the signs go the right way for you. Normally the signs go the wrong way, and you'd have two negatives or two positives on the right hand side. Okay, so what we're going to do, keeping this in mind in interpreting the numerics, what I want to do, I don't have time to show many of the numerics. I have three initial conditions, and I'll probably only have time to show one of them. Now, you have to bear in mind that in your initial conditions, those must satisfy the mean zero condition two for gamma. So you can't just choose anything you want. Okay, so we've chosen sine x, sine y as a convenient initial condition. Okay, and L is 2 pi, thank you, yes, L is 2 pi. And this is what you see. If I just show you the initial condition for gamma, the red says initial condition 1. It says gamma, you see here are two negative lobes for the sine x, sine y, and two positive lobes. Okay, so you would expect by what I was describing that these two negative lobes to go down and the positives to be suppressed in some particular way. And in fact, that's exactly what you see. Now, this picture is so compressed that it's virtually all black.
And continuum
limit. Yes, it's the continuum limit of the mesh. Very good. Yes. Okay. Now, this is what you just saw on the last slide. Two lobes and two positives. And you can see that these lobes, in one hidden behind the other, are growing downwards. They're like two liquid drops, actually. They're just falling down rapidly. You've got an amplification of 70 here. And for W, you have the same thing. Now, why for W? Well, dW by dt was minus gamma W. So large amplifications in negative gamma amplifies W as well. And so you've got, actually, an even stronger...
Your W behaves like a passive scalar in 2D, like a passive tracer or like a passive density.
Oh, I don't know.
I mean, the equation is d over dt w plus u grad w or plus d of u w. Which one is?
U grad w.
U grad w, so yes. It's a passive tracer.
Yes. Yes. Okay. Okay.
Now, what are you trying to show in d that you've got a little bit larger?
Sorry, this is gamma. These are gamma.
Yeah.
Okay, so it's amplifying negatively in gamma.
Yeah. Well, what is the red? This is a finite difference spectrum?
This is a pseudo-spectral calculation, okay. And for W, now, anybody who knows me, even half well, knows that I'm hopeless in numerics. Koji did these calculations with sort of me sort of sitting at his shoulder, and he did a 256 squared and a 512 and 1024, sort of, and in some cases 2048. Because it's not so difficult with this 2D particular 2D system, it's not that hard. He found that in most cases 256 squared was enough. However, there's a little twist to the tail of the numerics at the end, if I can get to it. And as I'm saying here, there is also this strong amplification of W here, and you see the flattening into almost like a plateau in W as we predicted. Now, that's in gamma and W. If you want to see the, this is in gamma, blown up better. So again, you see these two big dips like liquid drops down to minus 70. It started at minus, plus or minus 1. Okay. Whereas, in omega, what you actually have is that you started with sine x, sine y in omega. Although, and actually, you see, this looks like an amplification, but it only goes up to 6, whereas the other was like minus 200. So this isn't really, and what you're actually finding, these areas, these flattened areas in omega, are coincide roughly with the areas of negative gamma. The omega by dt is plus gamma omega, so negative gamma, you would expect it to sort of flatten down.
Is it possible to derive an equation for the density function of gamma?
The density function?
The PDF of gamma.
I suppose you might. I hadn't thought of it. Yeah, okay. So, in a sense, those calculations are really leading us to what we want for the full vorticity of the 3D system. Let's go back. Well, it's being depleted, but it's being, since gamma's negative, can be negative, it's actually being amplified.
Yeah.
And it, the issue, which will come up, is does gamma have a finite time singularity, negatively, going down to minus infinity? Now, that's one issue. Does this negative amplification, is it so fast that it produces a singularity, or is it just exponential? But I think more important than that is what does the actual full 3D vorticity, capital omega, look like? Because we have now gamma in here, and in here, and W in there with omega. You want to put these calculations into that formula and see what you get. So what does the full vortex look like? And the full vortex looks like this. But this is your initial condition, sine x, sine y, on gamma, omega, W. Let me pull this down a little, it's better. And then this goes through, t is... starts at t is 0, goes through 0.6, 1.2 and 1.4, which is just slightly before you sort of lose resolution in the scheme. And so what you're discovering is that these are the parts where those two negative lobes of gamma appeared. And it's really producing two cells. And the two cells, of course, have this sort of layering structure inside them where the vorticity is actually like in leaves, where it's high and low and high and low, which I can't explain. And so...
The vorticity is not monotonic?
No. Not across the radius, no. In fact, it's very low in some of these particular areas. Now, the reason is that it's opening out, of course, is that dvu is minus gamma. And if gamma amplifies negatively, then dvu becomes strongly positive, so the vortex actually starts to spread out. So you might start with an initial slim vortex, but basically it will open out as gamma goes very large and negative. It has to open out because dvu becomes positive. And so it's actually opening the vortex out like a flower in some ways, and these sorts of things give you evidence of like the petals of vorticity inside of it.
Why is it non-monotonic?
Yeah. I mean, if you took a slice through the plane z equals 0, what is the vorticity?
Oh, okay, let me explain what this is. I haven't... This is the z-axis. This is z, xy is the cross-section. This is the z-axis from 0 to... So everything's on the 2 pi cubed. Okay, now, when you say monotonic, in which direction?
Well, in our phase, in the vortex.
You mean this way?
No.
Okay, so we're going across the radius. Now, why do you think it should be monotonic?
Well, it's the Gaussian form for one that when you had a single one, it was just the Gaussian, the R squared, and all the gamma.
Well, no, that's just Berger's solution. This is a much more sophisticated solution.
What is it?
Well, it's this. Okay, let's go back. It's this object here, capital omega. Those are the three components. I've done them in Cartesian.
Z equal to zero, for example, z equal to any.
Okay, then I've still got wx and wy.
Yeah, but what is it? The s, is it monotonic? No, going out of the radius.
No, it's not. No. Not for these initial conditions.
Yes, right.
Yeah,
exactly.
Or does it oscillate,
right?
No, it's not. It doesn't.
Well, the picture you had before, the gamma picture, looks like it's...
First of all, you don't have a color map on it. I mean, the color map is very confusing because it seems that you have dark colors inside. Put it on again. I don't understand the color map.
Maybe the better picture is the one with the gammas where you have the two lobes coming down.
Okay. This is the vorticity.
What are the colors?
What does
orange mean?
Colors for vorticity models.
Yeah, well, I thought this is the usual. That red is high. It's the standard.
You have a hollow shell.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. So but there's many shells inside one another.
There's one shell.
Well, actually, it's a question of resolution. I think there's more than one. You've got a yellow, red, yellow, green.
Yeah. Well, I mean, if red is highest, so you go blue, yellow, red. That's monotonic. Then red, yellow, blue, that's monotonic.
Oh, is that what you're thinking of? All right.
Of course.
All right.
So basically, this particular initial condition generates a shell, a hollow shell vortex.
Yes. All right. Okay.
Okay. It introduces a length scale of some kind.
Yes.
Interesting part of the structure.
Yeah, right.
Yes. Yeah. Right. Yeah. Well, that brings me to the point I was about to make, that when you look at it, that virtually all the vorticity is driven into omega theta in this particular type of problem and not into axial. So it basically comes away from axial and into omega theta. And if you look at vortex lines, you can see it happening exactly like so. In the vortex lines, if you start with your initial conditions like this, then they're driven basically into omega theta here. Okay. And that would be because you see omega, little omega, which is the axial vorticity, is being suppressed because gamma is going very negative. Well, we think it is. Okay. So, that was one initial condition. And just in my last few minutes, if you want to do another initial condition, which is sort of like a Mexican hat, it's not very obvious. But you take a Mexican hat, so you've got a dip around the hat, then you find exactly that the dip around the hat actually starts to amplify. You can see it better actually down here. And we constructed this because we wanted something that was symmetric about R equals naught to just see what it did. And when you put the colour things into that one, you discover that you see the opening out of the vortex exactly in this particular way. And we did this in a sense. I didn't understand the question you put when you asked it earlier on, but because the sine x sine y initial condition isn't symmetric in R, you've got these bumps here and you've got your bumps across there. This one is axisymmetric across the center, so it basically opens the vortex out again, hollows it out in certain respects. Which is, now when we showed these pictures to Yves Couder, I knew nothing about the history of the literature of vortex breakdown, but he said, this is what we see in vortex breakdown experiments, that an initial vortex will hollow out and put most of the omega into omega theta. And that's, so I'm not claiming that we're explaining vortex breakdown, but we have a phenomenon that is sort of, you can say, is similar in that respect. Now, in my last 5 minutes, what are the numerical issues? In fact, I picked this out of Sid Leibovich's review in Annual Reviews 78, and this is exactly an experiment where you start with like a pencil vortex, which is represented as a Burgers vortex, and it basically opens out like a bubble, and it's pretty much hollow in terms of vorticity inside, and then the thing essentially collapses. And what you've got is almost all the vorticity is driven into azimuthal, into omega theta in this particular problem. So it's behaving in a similar way in this particular problem.
So in your case, time would be similar to going down.
Well, yes, ours would not be quite the same way because that's in time, whereas ours is in Z.
That's okay.
Yeah. Okay. So. Question, final question, is there a finite time singularity in gamma? Gamma going negative. That's the question. See, we want to look at this particular equation for gamma. And we want to see if we can observe one numerically and say perhaps yes or perhaps not. Actually, the answer ahead of time is actually yes, because Peter Constantine has proved it so analytically. But I just want to tell you the story, because there's a little twist at the end. I don't, unfortunately, have all the pictures with me. We have many more. But if one did, from the pseudo-spectral computation, if one plotted maximum of gamma versus T star minus T, where T star is your breakdown time, you look as if you're getting some reasonably straight line. This is gamma max, so this is negative gamma. You look as if you're getting some fairly straight line, although you wouldn't like to trust what's going on very close to T star. And if you wanted to do a crude fit, it looks like it's fitting T star minus T to the minus 1. But that's not really the whole story, and one would not like to build a case just simply on that sort of evidence. So what we did, and when I say we, I provided some of the mathematics, but Koji knew the method, and maybe some of you know this method, called a Dom-Sykes plot. And the Dom-Sykes plot, again, we were in luck, because if I define IP to be my integral of gamma to the P dx, now this is not a norm. This is not mod gamma P, because gamma can be negative and positive in different areas of my domain A. It's gamma to the P, and this is my gamma equation. IP dot, and that is exactly the gamma equation that we have. D gamma dt is minus gamma squared plus twice, and there is the L2 norm, I2. But then what one does is an expansion, Taylor expansion. This is a well-known method, I'm told, in numerical calculation. One gets a Taylor expansion, and you get this nasty recursion relation for the A's. And you can find various A's just from the properties. For instance, like when P is 1, the integral of gamma has to be 0. So you can find certain properties in that respect. Okay, now what you do is that you take your initial condition, and we took initial condition 1, sine x, sine y. You work out what the APs are for your initial condition, and that gives you a whole row of values. So you're not computing from one point, you're computing from a complete row. And then what you can do is that from that row of values, you can use this to calculate all these coefficients. And Koji worked very hard, he did it by MAPLE and got the 500 coefficients using MAPLE 5 from this initial condition. So this is an exact solution as a Taylor series. It's not much help as it stands, but it is an exact solution. Okay. So the question is, how do you interpret what that looks like? I'm almost done. Okay. Now, as far as I'm aware, as I'm told from the numerical analysis, one is looking at even and odd A's, and the ratio, if your ratio of these goes like so, you have to compute or calculate what alpha P and rho P are. And those, so the theory says, is that rho p is this, if, and alpha p would be your exponent. Okay.
The ratio method critical phenomenon, I guess.
I guess, yeah.
Say that again, the ratio method what?
I've seen Dohm's name back as far as papers in numerical analysis as back as not far as 1949. When this was published, I don't know. Yeah, okay. So if you do this analysis on the data, and if we go back to that previous slide, you actually find this is for alpha p versus p. So we've got a nice straight line. So we've got up to p equals 10. And these, you see, are those ratios of alpha p to n over 2n minus 1. So some very nice straight lines there. Then what we discovered, you see, you're interested in I2, which is the L2 norm. Does the L2 norm blow up? It looks numerically as if it does. Then we found that the blow-up time was 1.42, and that matches with 1.419 from loss of resolution on the pseudospectral scheme. So there's a reasonable sort of coincidence of evidence. That's for I2. Now, you see, it says that it's roughly, what did we get? Alpha 2 is 1.8, so it's not squared. Okay, it's 1.8.
What kind of confidence do you have in that number? Is it 1.8 or 1.9 or 2.0?
No, it's pretty close to 1.8. Yeah. You know, so
it would be good to put some error estimates on.
That's based on 500 coefficients.
Yes, that's based on 500 coefficients. That's right.
And how much okay. does that change between yeah. 400 and
500? Okay. And then, if you want to take t to infinity, that would give you the L infinity norm. And what you discover, what one discovers in this, that you see your formula goes like so. And one we found numerically that C1 was not quite 1. Okay. And as p goes to infinity, you're losing this term. So it isn't, according to this, the blow-up in gamma infinity is not quite 1, and it's not 1 in the L2 norm either. Not quite, but it's almost there. Okay, now that was where the picture stood. We believed that we...
Let's go back and remind us where this is being forced.
It's not.
It's infinite energy.
Yes.
Yeah.
So you can pull... You can pull particles from infinity
right.
and smack them in.
That's it.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right. So this is a. So if this is a singularity.
I remember there was something like that. This is for the benefit of those in the audience to say, aha.
Bob is prompting me in his own sweet way to say that. There is evidence for a singularity. In fact, there is a proof as well. But this is, of course, an entirely different type of animal than the calculation that Bob does, because his is finite energy blow up.
Right.
This is infinite energy because it's on an infinite domain. Thank you. Very good. Okay. So the twist in the tail was that we believed, we believed that the blow up seemed always to be in negative gamma and not positive, because you seem to have this suppression. But of course, as soon as the L2 norm has got enormously large, you've lost this suppressive effect on positive gamma. So, and Peter was interested in this calculation, and he took it a stage further, and it's in this preprint here. And what he proved was, in fact, he actually rigorously proved in this paper that, in fact, there is blow-up in gamma minus, but also in gamma plus. That just at the very last moment, because you've taken the brakes off the positive, that it blows up two-sidedly, and that gamma blows down in one place, because you're on a square, it blows down in one place negatively, and at the same time, but much more steeply, it actually suddenly the brakes come off and it blows up in gamma plus. So it's actually a two-sided blow-up. And the reason why probably we didn't quite get minus one for the blow-up, that the proof of the form of the singularity is that, you see, what does he have here? He has, look at this purple box. Gamma goes like log tau star minus t with this minus phi bar. This phi bar is a 1 over tau star minus t with this log. But tor star and tor are not actual time. They're related to real time down in this red box. T star minus T is this logarithmic combination. So you would have to unstitch this transcendental equation to get tor star minus tor in terms of T star minus T. So it is a T naught minus T to the minus one with a log correction in the actual blow up. And he, as he can show here, is of course it will blow up negatively here, but it can blow up positively there. But if you choose initial data here, such that there's a minus sign, then you can get a blow up there as well. I don't think he actually makes a remark, but
Lagrangian group, so he follows the largest point, so he doesn't
have anything
about
Lagrangian
groups. Yeah.
But you had L2 blowing up.
We have L2 blowing up. And so
power law that's quite a bit bigger than 1.42
or something. No, that was the blow up time.
Oh, that's the blow up time.
No, it was 1.0. It was 1.08.
So it's 1 over T, too.
Yes.
Well, the RMS is 1 over T.
The RMS squared went like 1.8. So the RMS squared.
But then you should take the square root, so it's like
0.9. So Koji went back and looked at his numerics much more closely, close to the blow-up time, and you can actually see that here's gamma blowing down negatively, and then it's more steep, you see. You think you're here, and you think it's okay, and then at the very last minute, it goes bang on you, you see. And that's exactly the two-sided blow-up. And so, in essence, there is a blow-up. So, in fact, what happens in these hollowed-out vortices, that everything, all the vorticity seems to go into omega theta in these hollowed-out vortices as you're coming down here. And then at that very last moment, because gamma plus blows up as well, you also get an enormous rush in axial omega as well, just at this very last moment. And then, of course, when it's blown up, it's really saying that Euler will not sustain a solution of this type, linear in Z. It simply won't do it, and so this solution is no longer valid. So, basically, I finished, but just in summary, in a sentence, I think I've provided you, I hope, with evidence that in effect, Berger's tight vortices have much more richness in them than we originally thought, and that there is a whole sort of dynamical and hollowing out behavior in a linear Z structure of this particular type. Okay, thank you.
Gamma negative saying that all the vorticity is going wrapped up this way.
Yeah, into omega theta.
And right in the middle at the very last time,
yeah.
It suddenly starts shooting up this way.
As well.
So you must have omega going nyo, 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 then taking this big...
Well, they both blow up, and so you've got omega theta,
right.
And then at that very fractional last, you've also got a shoot in axial
what
omega.
What I'm saying is that you've got a sudden curvature in the vortex.
Yeah.
Are they the same location?
No, because you the blow-up's in the square, and so you'll be it's at the same time, but at a different place, for obvious reasons.
These are unconnected points, then.
Yes. Yeah.
Now, as you move away, you see, does the azimuthal omega go into the linear omega? I couldn't figure it out. In other words, is it just azimuthal omega on the axis, where z is zero, in other words?
No, you'll have...
Does all of the longitudinal omega become...
Yes, it does, yes. But as you come up in Z, of course, the you're right, this cross-sectional structure will change,
yes.
Because you've got these Z gamma R and Z gamma theta terms that suddenly are non-zero as soon as you move off Z equals naught. So these sort of like shells will start to change. They won't remain, they're not uniform in Z, in other words, these shells. So they're really like a petal flower structure inside the vortex in some peculiar way. Well, it's not. So
this periodic array in 2D is unstable, right? It's a Pellegrin problem. Why would you see any kind of instability form?
Hang on, when you say periodic array in 2D, how do you mean?
Plus minus vorticity. At 4, you have 2 pluses and 2 minuses. If you make a perturbation to that, it's unstable and it breaks down in a pretty short time. It depends on the perturbation.
But this isn't 2D Euler as such.
But underlying it, it's 2D.
Yeah, it's 2D, but it's not 2D Euler.
He started out talking about. I think she's mixing up the first part of your talk and the later part.
Yes, thank you. You said it better than I could.
In other words, he's restricted the problem by solving a mathematical subset.
Yeah, absolutely right, which is linear in this Z. Yeah, okay. I have it in my office.
Okay, great.
Not really, no. Have you?
No, I haven't.
Do you want to wander across?
Yeah,
okay.
Did you try this new way these equations with viscosity?
Actually, yes, we did. Now, I didn't want to mention in public that Koji did, and he basically found that the blow-up persisted. And we were rather surprised, because I've got a whole bunch of spectral plots, and you actually find that it's the low-wave numbers and not the high-wave numbers that are doing the damage.
The gamma equation doesn't have viscosity, I guess, huh?
Yes, it would. If you put viscosity in, it would have a Laplacian.
But it still overcomes the...
Yes, it does. And I think it's this infinite domain thing that it can still pull the particles in. And when you look at the spectra, it's a low wave number phenomenon, not high wave number.
So you can just throw Laplacian.
You can, in effect, throw Laplacian away. Yeah. So essentially, the results appear to be roughly the same for Navier-Stokes. You just change the time, the blow up time, and it seems to be.
No, I've probably showed you this before. But one of the properties of my calculation is that as I'm pulling vorticity out of my singular regions I'm getting that.
Yes.
Okay.
Is this up here?
Yes, that's up there.
That's up there, I remember
that's up
that.
There. Now, if I have a singularity, I have to have infinite vortex line length. So the infinite vortex line length has to go somewhere, and this is where it goes.
Yeah.
But locally, there.
Yeah.
It looks an awful lot like your calculation.
Yeah.
This might.
Well, if this is a linear tube, in a sense, morally, maybe it's doing what?
That's what I'm thinking.
Yeah. So you think things are all going into omega theta in here?
Yeah.
It could
that's
be.
What it looks like.
Yeah. It could make sense.
This might give us. Some idea, some later stage, something down the line, how much makes sense.
Yeah.
That's what turns into turbulence.
Yeah.
Because,
well, you know,
you get reconnection, all this stuff, and everything goes like that.
You see, Leibovitz's picture, have you got the chalk? Leibovitz's picture, which I showed you, which basically opens out. Basically, after that's broken down, where you've got all the omega, basically, you've got a turbulent wake behind it.
Yes.
And that's really what creates.
Yes.
That's really what creates, because the whole thing, solution structure fails. Of course, it doesn't mean to say here that Euler has failed. It just means it has to jump to a completely different solution.
Right.
Yes. Yes, in fact, you can see here. You see in this?
Yeah, well, I mean, I was looking at the same thing that John Lopez was showing in Arizona.
Yeah. 2 weeks ago. Yeah, exactly. Now, this is probably, it's not a crude explanation of vortex breakdown, it's an example of vortex. It's an example of an analytical solution that produces similar effects.
Right.